system, a part of which is being built in Wilton, Connecticut, will use a new trick to minimize the wavelength of light it uses, shrinking the size of features on the resulting chips and boosting their performance more than ever. The pace of that miniaturization is known as Moore's Law, named after Gordon Moore, a co-founder of the chip giant Intel. ASML introduced the first extreme ultraviolet lithography machines for mass production in 2017, after decades spent mastering the technique. Known as high-NA technology, it will be crucial for making more advanced smartphones and cloud computers, and also for key areas of emerging technology such as artificial intelligence, biotechnology and robotics. The first chips made using the new system may be minted by Intel, which has said it will get the first of them expected by 2023. But how does it all work? A chip starts out life as a cylindrical chunk of crystalline silicon that is sliced into thin wafers, which are then coated with layers of light-sensitive material and repeatedly exposed to patterned light. The parts of silicon not touched by the light are then chemically etched away to reveal the intricate details of a chip. Each wafer is then chopped up to make lots of individual chips. Shrinking the components of a chip remains the surest way to squeeze more computational power out of pieces of silicon because electrons pass more efficiently through smaller electronic components. Reducing the wavelength of light used in chip manufacturing has helped drive miniaturization and progress from the 1960s onwards, and it is crucial to the next advance. Machines that use visible light are replaced by those that use near-ultraviolet, which in turn gave way to systems that employ deep ultraviolet in order to etch ever smaller features into chips. Generating extreme ultraviolet light is itself a big problem. ASML's method involves directing high-power lasers at droplets of tin, 50,000 times per second, to generate high-intensity light. Lenses absorb extreme ultraviolet frequencies, so the system uses incredibly precise mirrors, built by 175-year-old German optics firm Zeiss Group, coated with special materials instead. The six specially shaped mirrors are ground, polished and coated over several months in an elaborate robotic process that uses ion beams to remove defects. Inside ASML's machine, extreme ultraviolet light bounces off the mirrors before passing through the reticle, which moves with nanoscale precision to etch features just a few dozen atoms in size onto future computer chips. Amid the recent chip shortage, ASML's products have become central to a geopolitical struggle between the United States and China, with Washington making it a high priority to block China's access to the machines. So far, the US government has successfully pressured the Dutch not to grant the export licenses needed to send the machines to China. Will Hunt, a research analyst at Georgetown University studying the geopolitics of chipmaking, says, "You can't make leading-edge chips without ASML's machines." He added, A lot of it comes down to years and years of tinkering with things and experimenting, and it's very difficult to get access to that. He says each component that goes into an extreme ultraviolet machine is astonishingly sophisticated and extraordinarily complex. ASML's current generation of extreme ultraviolet machines can create chips with a resolution of 13 nanometers. The next generation will use High-NA to craft features 8 nanometers in size. The extreme ultraviolet market is highly consolidated, as ASML is the only manufacturer of lithography machines that use extreme ultraviolet light. Asia-Pacific continues to hold the largest revenue share in the global market for extreme ultraviolet lithography, with Taiwan expected to have an edge in the region over the forecast period from 2021 to 2026. The boom in demand means that ASML's executive team now expects the company to post a 35% jump in sales this year, compared with the 14 billion euro total posted in 2020. The company's chief executive officer, Peter Wennink, says that in addition to demand from chip manufacturers, ASML is set to benefit from a trend towards technological sovereignty, with the United States and Europe looking to ensure local production of critical semiconductors. The chief executive officer of ASML is expecting continued long-term demand growth to meet the needs of what he calls intelligent distributed systems that combine sensors with computation. Peter Wennink added, "It's the further rollout of 5G and 6G. It's the progress we're making on artificial intelligence and self-driving cars."
We the people.
Freedom of speech.
The freedom of speech has been fought for hundreds of years in the United States. But now many are afraid it is only an illusion in American universities. Every year, some academic professors and faculty members are denied their tenure or flat out lose their jobs for expressing views which threaten a powerful entity in the U.S. So does freedom of speech even exist in America?
All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press.
Hello and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. Now, if you've watched the previous episodes of our show, you'll know that we discuss social, political, and economic matters of the United States and also the country's relations and activities throughout the world. On this episode, we'll speak about the freedom of speech and how many faculty members in the U.S. universities have lost their jobs for expressing views and opinions. Please stay tuned.
We won't back down!
Stop the witch hunt!
Come here now!
We will resist!
We won't back down!
Stop the witch hunt!
Come here now!
We won't back down!
Students all around the world go to universities to gain knowledge and expertise. Universities are where new ideas are heard and debated. University students do not appreciate being told what views they are permitted to hold and what views are not allowed. The same, of course, is true for professors and lecturers.
Freedom of speech, it's another slogan we hear repeated time and again in America. Numerous intellectuals and faculty members of universities have been harassed, coerced, and have oftentimes lost their jobs for expressing views and activism. We're now joined by Don DeBar, activist, commentator, and radio host and journalist at CPR News, and asked him about the situation of freedom of speech in the United States, and especially in U.S. universities.
The state of freedom of speech in the United States now is about where it was rumored to be, alleged to be, in the Soviet Union in perhaps 1952, 1953, when Stalin was still alive.
Recently, higher education institutions have denied academic tenure to prominent intellectuals like Cornel West at Harvard University. He is one of America's most prominent African-American scholars and an outspoken progressive activist. Cornel West accused Harvard University of intellectual and spiritual bankruptcy of deep debts.
You've suggested that, Professor West, that you believe some of the reasons that you were denied tenure were your support for Palestinian rights as well as for Senator Bernie Sanders. Can you elaborate on both?
Well, I argued to myself it could either be age, but I'm giving the Gifford lectures, kind of Nobel Prize version of philosophical lectures. So someone in Scotland feels that I still have something to say. So it couldn't be age. It couldn't be academics because I'd published 20-some books. I was a university professor at Harvard, university professor at Princeton. I got tenure at Yale 37 years ago, so it's a joke. It's just ludicrous and ridiculous that they would be so hesitant to allow for a tenure process to go forth. So I figured it had to be political. And the most taboo issue on U.S. campuses these days in many instances has to do with the vicious Israeli occupation of precious Palestinians.
The 68-year-old scholar suggested in his resignation letter that politics was the main reason Harvard University denied him tenure, citing his support for the Palestinian cause.
Professor West, of course, he had public disputes with the sacred cow at the time, the CEO of Harvard University, Larry Summers. Now, Larry Summers, philosophically, you can make deductions about from his resume. CEO of the World Bank, a high administration official in Bill Clinton's administration. He's one of the people that's either close to the actual people who run things or one of them that actually run things. And so if you have people that are criticizing a society that commits murder on a daily basis around the world, that has poverty within the wealthiest nation in the world to the extent the United States does, which is an embarrassment to the rest of the civilized, or I should say to the civilized world, then you also are going to be going hat in hand for tenure.
In April of 2021, Nicole Hannah-Jones, who won a 2020 Pulitzer Prize for her groundbreaking 1619 project for the New York Times Magazine, was denied a tenured position at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill after the university's Board of Trustees took the highly unusual step of failing to approve the journalism department's recommendations.
Protests today after a professor in the UNC Journalism Department has offered a teaching contract without tenure. Nicole Hannah-Jones created the New York Times 1619 Project. It reframes the country's history around slavery and discusses contributions of African Americans. The university chancellor and the chair of the Board of Trustees, however, are defending their move. Both say that the tenure process was followed in this case, but when it was time for a vote, Hannah-Jones' application did not include a tenure option.
One of the people who raised objections to her was UNC megadonor Walter E. Hussman Jr., after whom the university's Hussman School of Journalism and Media was named. He had donated over $25 million to that institution. Our next guest is author and attorney Michael Springman. Now, Mr. Springman, who are behind-the-scene players which put pressure on these universities to silence their opposition or those who threaten their interests?
Well, it's a variety of organizations. There's the United States government, which shut down on two occasions the online newspaper American Herald Tribune. There are the rich donors that pressure universities to suppress freedom of speech if it's critical of Israel or any other sort of ism or attitude or country. Then there's B'nai B'rith and the Anti-Defamation League. They put pressure overtly and covertly on donors and people in the university management.
Walter Hussman Jr. objected to Nicole Hannah-Jones' assertion in her 1619 Project essay that American colonists waged the Revolutionary War to preserve slavery. He also took issue with her statement that blacks, for the most part, fought back alone, against discrimination, against violence and subjugation.
We're investing in Carolina and journalism because it's a very important time in America. Americans are beginning to realize they need to trust a trusted source of professional journalism. And we need to renew the values and standards and practices that have stood the test of time in journalism to renew that trust with the American people.
Walter Hussman is a graduate of this school. He is one of us. He is a Tar Heel. This naming gift means that we will have an endowment, $25 million to build for the future.
After protests and objections by university faculty and students alike, and the threat of legal action by Nicole Hannah-Jones's lawyers, the university finally offered her tenure at the end of June, after which Nicole Hannah-Jones refused the offer and joined Howard University instead.
Well, until very recently, my expectation was that I would remain at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill as well. As I've said, this is my alma mater. I wasn't seeking to go into academia. It was this particular job at this particular place that I wanted to go and give back to the university that helped me build the career that I've built. But things really shifted after the story went public. A couple of things. I didn't have any idea the extent to which political interference had led to my being denied the tenure that every other Knight professor before me had achieved.
Over the years, faculty from different universities have been harassed, denied tenure, or even fired from their positions under a different pretext, but ultimately because they had strong views which opposed the official beliefs of the United States. Universities are often funded by wealthy institutions or individuals which will deny their donations if the university does not fire a certain faculty member who's expressed views against them or their beliefs.
In essence, an empire, an imperial structure, you know, late stage or late stage, however you want to characterize it, capitalist, colonialism, imperialism, that has control of more than half of the population and most of the resources of the world, with about 800 military bases of the United States and its allies placed around the world to maintain that control, a variety of dictatorships of that class, essentially, running most of the countries of the world as agents, you know, as compradors, as, you know, we're seeing now the people who are trying to run out of Afghanistan, for example, even the low-level and mid-level officials. This structure exists all over the world.
In another example, the trustees of the University of Illinois voted in 2014 to block the appointment of Stephen Salater, a Palestinian-American professor who had been offered a tenured position in 2013. However, following a campaign by pro-Israel students, faculty members and donors contended that his Twitter comments about the bombardment of the Gaza Strip by the Israeli military were anti-Semitic.
We end today's show with professor and author Stephen Salater. Last year, his job offer for a tenured position for the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign was withdrawn after he posted tweets harshly critical of the 2014 Israeli assault on Gaza. The school had come under pressure from donors, from students, parents, and alumni critical of Salida's views, with some threatening to withdraw financial support. The move was criticized both in and outside of the school, with administrators accused of political censorship.
Mr. Salater had been scheduled to teach two classes in the university's American Indian Studies department that fall, before supporters of Israel drew attention to his Twitter feed, where he had expressed outrage over Israel's Gaza offensive.
Well, people who are outspoken critics of Israel and the United States lose their jobs, are sidelined. They're unable to publish. I've spoken with a well-known journalist, and she's told me any number of times that the extremist organizations and the establishment all work together and are well-funded, but if you try to provide the correct attitude and an explanation of what's really happening in the world, you're simply shunted off to the side, and nobody has any money to pay you to live on while you're writing these articles critical of the establishment and Israel.
Salaita had written a tweet in 2014 that read, "The logic of anti-Semitism deployed by Zionists, if applied in principle, would make pretty much everybody not a sociopath anti-Semitic."
Salaita later went to the American University of Beirut, in which he taught for a year. Then U.S. senators and university donors pressured the university president into canceling his appointment.
I was at Virginia Tech as a tenured English professor. I was offered the job at the University of Illinois. I subsequently signed a contract that the University of Illinois then countersigned, and everything was set up for me to move and begin my position. Within around a week of my physical move from Virginia to Illinois, I received a termination letter out of nowhere from the chancellor, which just sort of threw my life into disarray. I all of a sudden didn't have an income and health insurance or a place to live. We had to cancel the contract.
Your whole family was moving.
Yeah, my whole family was moving. And so we ended up living with my parents. And then, you know, after around a year of sort of going to different places around the country and speaking about the situation, I was offered a one-year visiting professorship at the American University of Beirut, and that's where I am now.
Stephen Salaita later leaves academia, and as of 2019, since he was not hired by any other university, he became a school bus driver in suburban Washington, D.C. This brings us to the question of what are the risks of being an outspoken critic of Israel and United States' policies?
Well, let's pick the two former members of Congress who were the most outspoken on that. Cynthia McKinney, ex-Representative Cynthia McKinney, the ex being the relevant part, and Dennis Kucinich, again, ex-Representative Dennis Kucinich. In each case, they had spoken out. In fact, Cynthia McKinney informed the world that AIPAC had brought, or some other agent of the State of Israel, to her as a member of Congress, a statement to sign pledging, you know, that we will look out for and make sure Israel, our best friend, gets whatever it needs from the U.S. Congress. She refused to sign it because she considered it a violation of her oath of office and perhaps of some corruption statutes also. She spoke out loud about it. And she was painted as an anti-Semite, as a lunatic. She was set up by the Capitol Police.
Now, the right to freedom of speech was recognized in the U.S. Bill of Rights back in 1791. In the U.S., freedom of speech and constitutional limits to it have been defined in practice by rulings from the Supreme Court.
The IWW trial was the largest mass trial in the history of the United States. 101 defendants, 101 convictions. Everybody who went to trial was convicted. Those who did not evade U.S. jurisdiction went to prison for it. What was it they went to prison for? Sedition. And what was the sedition? Telling draft-age men in the United States not to go to World War I. That's it, the land of free speech.
Even though on paper you are supposed to have the right to freedom of speech, in practice there are things you're just not supposed to say.
I just named some. The State of Israel as the, you know, holy ghost of the American people or whatever, that's one. You can't challenge that role. The U.S. military and American imperialism in general.
Outspoken activist and professor of the University of Colorado Boulder from 1990 through 2007, Ward Churchill was fired from his university post after his essay written in the wake of the September 11 attacks gained attention years later. He's dubbed by dominant corporate U.S. media as hater of America.
So we have no moral high ground when it comes to America versus ISIS.
I've seen American moral high ground at work in Southeast Asia. Thank you very much. And the answer to that would be an absolute no.
Churchill had argued the September 11 attacks were a natural and unavoidable consequence of unlawful U.S. foreign policy over the latter half of the 20th century. The essay is known for Churchill's use of the phrase Little Eichmanns, a comparison to the Nazi bureaucrat to describe the technocratic corps working at the World Trade Center in New York.
Every Palestinian child shot in the head for throwing a rock in the Intifada is being shot with munitions provided by the United States. The munitions are fired from a rifle provided by the United States. When they look up and see those helicopters that are taking out apartment blocks because they suspect somebody they don't like is in there, collateral damage ensues. The helicopter and the missile are provided by the taxpayers of the United States. And see, the problem is not just that the material, the monetary support, and the political endorsements provided by the government of the United States, but there's this overwhelming embrace of the policy by the general citizenry of the United States.
In March of 2005, because the university couldn't go after the professor for expressing his views in an essay, they began investigating allegations that Churchill had engaged in research misconduct, and in 2006, they reported that indeed he had engaged in such misconduct.
In terms of the role of universities in the United States, their funding stream shifted from private donations and federal grant money starting in the really post-war period, post-World War II period, to where the military and the intelligence services and large corporations became the primary sources of their funding, even dwarfing tuition as a source, for example.
Churchill was fired on 24th of July 2007, despite having tenure. He then filed a lawsuit against the University of Colorado for unlawful termination of employment. And a Denver jury found that Churchill was indeed unjustly fired by the university, awarding him just $1 in damages in 2009.
A jury says the University of Colorado was wrong to fire Professor Ward Churchill. That verdict came after just more than a day of deliberations. CBS 4's Carlin Tilley is outside the court in downtown Denver. Carlin, we still don't know, though, if Churchill will indeed get the job back.
That was the one verdict not delivered today, but there were three verdicts that were delivered today. One, were Ward Churchill's freedom of speech rights violated, and did the university act inappropriately? Yes. Was Ward Churchill wrongfully fired? Yes. Did the university have enough reason to fire Churchill otherwise? The answer to that was no. Churchill's lawyers patted him on the back as the verdict was read. The jury only awarded him $1 in damages, but Churchill says he never asked for money. He asked for justice and for his job back.
Later that year, a district court judge vacated the monetary award and declined Churchill's request to order his reinstatement, deciding that the university has quasi-judicial immunity. Churchill appealed that decision, and the Court of Appeals upheld the lower court's ruling in favor of the university. And then in 2013, the Supreme Court outright declined to even hear the case.
I see happening here is the government, in collusion with the corporate media, is creating a lynch mob. They're advocating a lynch mob to lynch Ward. Now, the danger in that, and it's my belief that the government of the state of Colorado, legislature and the governor, are in lockstep with the corporate media to incite some nut to kill him.
Now, freedom in the United States is a huge sham. Freedom might be provided in insignificant and trivial areas, while it is taken away where it counts most by whatever means necessary.
Well, U.S. universities are in the forefront of thought control and of blocking any alternative viewpoints being presented if it's an unpopular one. Fordham University, a couple of years ago, refused to permit Palestinians on campus to demonstrate and to speak out against Israel. They shut them down. They canceled their demonstrations. They canceled their organization. So, and that's a good Catholic university run by the Jesuits. So it's a situation where the university is simply are working hand in glove with the extremists and the people who want to prevent you from thinking.
I'm at the
Paul student as well, and I mean, and a fan of Finkelstein. But I think that at the simplest level, this is about, as a student, we should be able to learn what we want to learn.
Yeah, I read about
and we're essentially, this is an academic voice that's being silenced.
Norman Finkelstein, outspoken activist and critic of Israel and supporter of Palestinian rights, was denied tenure at DePaul University after a feud with Alan Dershowitz on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Finkelstein had been teaching political science at DePaul for over 6 years.
All this process of voting for the tenure is really a charade, because the ultimate power here is the president.
This is just the tip of the iceberg. For many years, activists, faculty members, and intellectuals have been silenced forcefully by various powerful elite groups, individuals, and officials in the country.
Well, in the United States, freedom of expression is failing. It's obsessed with people being right and you're being wrong. And as far as the universities go, it's pretty much the same. They seem to be controlled by extremist groups and organizations with lots of money to shut down any kind of opposition to the established order of things.
One should not forget that the professors who are fired or denied tenure are also being made examples. By looking at these examples, other faculty members who are looking to advance their careers in the academia will self-censor, and they refrain from saying something controversial so as not to disrupt their tenure track.
Well, that was our show this week, everyone. Thank you. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. Do join us next week on another episode of We the People. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
As sovereign nations, indigenous groups, and Native American tribes are using their authority to make their own rules to protect students and teachers as COVID-19 cases surge. We're prepared for you an article written by Hallie Golden. The piece is titled, Native American Tribes Enforce Mask Mandates Regardless of State Bans. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Please stay with us for more of Hallie Golden's article. Native American tribes across the handful of U.S. states with bans on school mask mandates have asserted their powers as sovereign nations to defy the orders, with some also implementing their own testing and vaccine directives for tens of thousands of students and faculty in schools on their reservations as COVID-19 cases surge. Under America's Constitution, federally recognized tribes such as the Navajo Nation and the Cherokee Nation have self-governing authority and so have been able to implement mask mandates despite the statewide bans. Jason Dropick, board president of the National Indian Education Association and the head of the Indian Community School in Wisconsin, said the majority of native communities he had heard from in states with these bans have implemented mask mandates. He explained the reasoning often had to do with the fact that the indigenous Americans have had to deal with a disproportionately high death toll from COVID. According to an analysis released in February, one in every 475 Native Americans has died since the pandemic started, a greater proportion relative to any other demographic in the country. Jason Dropick said, "When we have loss, and we have it every year, even outside of a pandemic, but when you increase that amount of loss, there are ways of being that just don't continue to be taught, and that can be lost completely." He added, "It's not solely a matter of someone's life, which is in and of itself hugely impactful, but also those ways of being, cultural traditions, language, and work that also sometimes pass with our native speakers." State leaders in Oklahoma, Utah, Arizona, Iowa, and South Carolina have implemented bans on mask mandates in schools. The Education Department's Civil Rights Enforcement Arm announced on Monday, 30th of August, that it had launched an investigation into five states to determine whether their ban on mask mandates is discriminatory against students with disabilities. Leaders in Florida, Texas, Arkansas have also added bans, but due to legal challenges, they either are not enforcing those bans or have been blocked completely. Navajo Nation, the U.S.'s largest tribe, reaffirmed a mask mandate at the beginning of August for the 133 schools with students from preschool to 12th grade on its reservation, covering more than 27,000 square miles in Utah, Arizona, and New Mexico. The Navajo Nation president, Jonathan Nez, said students and staff have diligently followed the requirement. He said, as of recent days, there has been no evidence of COVID spread within the schools so far this school year. The president of the Navajo Nation, Jonathan Nez, attributed this success in part to COVID not being politicized inside the tribe, but rather framed in a historical context as the latest monster plaguing the community that must be vanquished. He said, "With any war, any battles, you've got to be equipped and you've got to have your armor. And you've got to have your weapons," he added. "And one of the armors that we have is the vaccine. And one of the weapons that we have is wearing face masks and using hand sanitizers. And so we framed it in that way to where our elders can understand what we're dealing with. And they assisted and helped us talk to our younger generation." The Meskwaki Settlement School, which is property of the Sac and Fox tribe of the Mississippi and is the only federally recognized native tribe in Iowa, also announced a mask requirement for students and staff. And in Arizona, the Hopi tribe and the White Mountain Apache tribe mandated masks in schools. COVID cases on the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma have risen sharply since July, with weekly case totals reaching more than 1,000 in August. Over the summer, tribal leaders made the decision to implement a mask requirement for hundreds of students in its high school and immersion school for a new school year. They also included weekly COVID testing requirements in the schools and vaccination mandates for extracurricular activities. The Cherokee Nation Principal Chief, Chuck Hoskin Jr., described schools as some of the safest places you can go in the area thanks to these protocols. He said there have been only two cases of COVID documented this school year. But more than 95% of students on the reservation attend an Oklahoma public school, which, although located on the reservation, is not run by indigenous leaders. The Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin described the situation as frustrating and said he couldn't recall any other time when the tribe's school system took a different approach on health from Oklahoma public schools. He said, in terms of the operations and basic things like health and safety, it has never frankly occurred to me as a tribal leader that the schools operating within our reservation by the state would fall so woefully short of such a basic health and safety measure. He added, COVID and the law pushed the governor, Kevin Stitt, has changed all that, of course, and I hope it's an anomaly. He added, unfortunately, even if it is an anomaly, it's coming at a great cost. Tahlequah, Oklahoma, which is the capital of the Cherokee Nation, the Tahlequah Public School Superintendent reported recently that in the first 10 days of school, they saw over 100 cases of COVID. Later in the week, the schools opted to move all elementary sites to distance learning until 3rd of September due to staff shortages and rising cases for both staff and students. Other tribes in these regions have faced similar situations in which their schools, their students attend, do not fall under the jurisdiction of the tribe. For example, the Cheyenne and the Arapaho tribes do not have any reservation land, so students attend public schools in Oklahoma. The Cheyenne and the Arapaho Department of Education Executive Director, Carrie Whitlow, explained that although the tribes take a serious stance on COVID safety protocols, there have been mask mandates for children over 5 years old and teachers, and testing and vaccination requirements for teachers in its 2 child care centers and 3 Head Start centers. Its leaders have not had a say when it comes to rules in public schools. She said, "We're really trying to do our best," adding, "However, because of our lack of authority in public school districts, they don't really seek the advice of us from a tribe and tribal education department, as far as our students and their families, and how do we protect them. But tribal leaders have continued to make sure students always have access to face masks and understand the importance of them." Earlier this month, the education department's Facebook page featured a message from Whitlow wishing students a safe and healthy school year. She added, "Please do your best to protect your homes and communities by wearing face masks."
Ministry.
West Asia's contradictions were all present in the form of official representatives who met in the Iraqi capital Baghdad during the Conference of Cooperation and Partnership in an unprecedented event that brought together opposites to one table except for Syria. Through the gates of Baghdad, the opposites arrived. For nearly a decade, Iraq had not witnessed a meeting of this magnitude. The delegations of the countries of Iran, Kuwait, Qatar, Egypt, Turkey, Jordan, the Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and France all met in the capital of Mesopotamia. The Iraqi goal seems to be preparing Baghdad to be a link between the region's rivals as the Afghani scene of chaos post-U.S. withdrawal hunts the officials in Iraq. The Cooperation and Partnership Conference is being promoted by Iraq as a prelude to a Baghdad declaration, hoping to dissolve the regional dispute between the resistance axis and the foreign interference camp, based on the possibility that Iraq can become a common ground for communication between the delegations of attending state representatives and those who might join them later. Maybe Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa Gadamy truly believes that Iraq can be future ground for diffusing regional tension between Iran and the United States, but the question is, has he been following the scandalous American withdrawal from Afghanistan and the chaos that followed? If so, then for sure Gadamy must know that hosting summits in hope for easing the upcoming U.S. withdrawal, which in no way will happen in a calm and civilized manner, since hello, this is the U.S. we're talking about, will not be enough to solve any of the critical challenges headed towards Iraq in the upcoming few months. Adding salt to the injury, in a major summit hosting regional states that supposedly is meant to promote peace and reconciliation, Syria, which shares a 599-kilometer border with Iraq, was not present. It was not even invited. Baghdad claims that it has informed Damascus of the terms and dimensions of this summit, but I seriously have no idea how that will promote any peace inside Syria when the majority of those attending the Baghdad summit are directly involved in promoting Wahhabi terrorism, foreign intervention, and mayhem in Syria over the past 11 years. One fresh voice broke the monotonous setting. It was that of new Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian, who affirmed that security can be achieved only through mutual trust, reliance on national capabilities, strengthening relations and good neighborliness, while maintaining a non-interference of foreign countries in the region policy, a policy that seems too much for most of the pro-U.S. regional states to understand. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Hosted a regional summit on Saturday supposedly aimed at easing tensions in the Middle East while emphasizing the Arab country's new role as a mediator. Heads of state attending, including Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, King Abdullah II of Jordan, Qatari Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad al-Thani, and French President Emmanuel Macron. Now, Iran, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia sent their foreign ministers, while Kuwait and the United Arab Emirates sent their heads of government. The summit was held against the impact of the re-emergence of Daesh, which was defeated in Iraq in 2017 and in Syria in 2018 at the hands of the Iraqi resistance with direct support from martyr Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, while the major transformational events in Afghanistan are center stage. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Mohsen Saleh, political commentator and academic. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Saleh. Now, some local and regional media were considered in the past a couple of days with the Baghdad summit, where regional and neighboring countries attended in a bid to ease the tensions over this volatile region of West Asia. Yet one major country which shares a border of 599 kilometers with Iraq, aka Syria, was not there. It was not even invited to the summit. How can a summit on the border with Syria, supposedly promoting peace and reconciliation, not even see Syria attending?
This meeting actually has no substantial strategic role in the region, because they are using these words to mean something else. Macron and Saudis and the Emirates and also whoever these people who were there, they are trying to snatch Iraq from the axis of resistance, and that's what Biden in his statement he said about sharing something strategic role and partnership and these words with Iraq, as if he did not occupy Iraq and did not do all the corrupt and killings and massacres and partitions in Iraq. I guess we have to be cautious about this meeting. This meeting, as I said, has no substantial role. It's only as some Iraqi diplomats talked about just the meeting, the mere meeting in Iraq, in Baghdad.
Well, but something happened during that summit.
So they are disregarding Syria, to finish with this statement. Mm-hmm. They are disregarding or trying not to invite Syria because the Arab League, what so-called Arab League, must be angry about inviting Syria, and Syria still and stands still with the access of resistance and would not bow for the
American
orders.
Well, it is obvious, Dr. Saleh. It is obvious that
yes.
If they did actually invite Syria, it means that they are blatantly accepting that they have been defeated in the face of Syria and its allies. But one important thing happened on Saturday was an Iranian and Persian Gulf Arab officials meeting in Baghdad on the sidelines of this regional summit in Iraq. How much of a real change will that bring to probably, let's say, the Wahhabi terrorism or to the encouraging of these regional Persian Gulf countries of the infesting of terrorism and corruption in Iraq or in Syria or elsewhere? How serious are these talks that happened at the sidelines there between the Persian Gulf Arab states and Iran?
Well, that's clear that it's a prelude for the American withdrawal, but keeping its role with these instruments in Iraq and trying to let them involve, especially the Saudis and the French and the Egyptians, go into Iraq and try to talk to the Iraqis and formulate a new government that would be consistent with its strategic role with the Americans. They want to bring all these countries, what so-called the neighboring countries, except for Syria, and they brought in. it's really funny, Turkey. That's this state occupying some parts of Iraq, and they are threatening the security of the Iraqis by hitting, striking, and doing all the bad things to the Iraqis and the
this
Syrians.
This is how I saw it as well, Dr. Mohsen. I saw it like them inviting the people who created all the mayhem and the chaos in Iraq and in Syria, people who are occupying Iraq and Syria, and people who funded terrorism in Iraq and Syria. But at the end of the day, they had to invite Iran because they had no other excuse but to invite Iran because of its strategic role. And yet it was Iran that put their faces in a very serious tone when they said what needed to be said. But resistance against the U.S. influence in West Asia between Iran and the axis of resistance on one side and the United States and all of these people you just mentioned on the other side, they made Iraq the scene of assassinations of Iranian and Iraqi resistance leaders, and Iraq was also a base for counter attacks against this U.S. occupation, these attacks led by the resistance as well. How much would a French-sponsored rapprochement, because it was obvious that Macron's role was actually to put them on the table altogether, but how much of a sponsorship coming from the French side would bring a change to the ground in the Iraq, especially that the U.S. is not even taking part of the summit, yet it seemed like it was dictating the summit?
Well, actually, they have brought everybody that would not belong to the axis of resistance or talk about the barbaric role of the United States and all its allies in this region. And they are going so far in order to bring Iraq to their table and to make this distance, as I said, to between Iraq and Syria and also Iran. Calling or inviting Iran is something diplomatic because the conference has a kind of media role more than making role. And in this region, as we know, the effective role of the resistance is really fatal. And really, we cannot talk about the region without resistance, because as we know that they haven't talked absolutely about Palestine and the Israeli occupation of Palestine and the killing of the Palestinians, and they haven't talked about also the tournament or the poverty in Iraq, and they talked about the infrastructure and the this kind of cooperation between the Iraqi government and the regional government.
I still have 2 minutes before this segment ends, and I want to hear more about this in the second segment. But there's something very important that happened. You put it clearly that they were talking about things that did matter, but things that they are not a priority. But something vital happened. It was the presence of the Iranian foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, who sent a crucial message to the summit attendees as he visited the memorial site in Baghdad International Airport, where Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and his comrade of Mahdi al-Muhandis were assassinated by the United States of America. He also reaffirmed during the summit that there will be no security as long as there is foreign intervention in the region as a total, and in Iraq in specific. From that point, what was the point of the Iranian participation here, knowing that this is their view? This is their view, and they just brought it to the table.
You know, what I think is that their meeting in Iraq, in order to say to Iran, look, whatever you have shared, participated, a great role in defeating ISIS and Daesh and all the terrorists, actually, we are here. The Saudis are here, the Egyptians, the Jordan, and the Emirates. And of course, pushed by the Americans in order to say, well, look, we are concerned about Iraq, not the Iranians. Whatever you have done, paid, blood, money, culture, history, whatever you have done, only we are the ones who can do something for Iraq from infrastructure in order to deal with this new government. They don't care. Of course, they want to do say to the Iraqis that whatever martyrs Qasem Soleimani, everybody knows in Iraq Qasem Soleimani, the leader, the great leader, the general, and everybody knows also Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, the great martyr in Iraq, and they have paid homage to these martyrs in Iraq and in Iran. Millions of people, they went there in order to for their cemetery and to say bye and to thank them and to really read Al-Fatiha on them and do all that. But these countries, actually the Gulf countries, they want to say that whatever happened, we are here. And of course,
Let us move on together to see how they are trying to buy off Iraq, while at the same time Iraq is very concerned of turning into an Afghanistan and another Afghanistan because of the U.S. occupation's withdrawal in such a dramatic way. Please stay tuned, because our next segment will be continuing to talk about this specific matter.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
At a time when the Afghan factor today represents a number of serious challenges that the neighboring Central and West Asian countries will have to face at the local and the regional levels,
first and foremost security issues. There are files and crises that have come to the fore in the past few weeks until these coming days. Having watched the U.S. fail to evacuate